Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Two bills approved in the state Senate this week could affect President Donald Trump and his associates. One would permit the state tax department to give the president's New York tax returns to congressional committees. The other would ensure that anyone the president pardons for federal crimes could still be prosecuted for crimes committed in New York State. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Senate leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins predicts the measures will have a major impact both nationally and in New York State.
The president and his administration has repeatedly shown a true hostility to the rule of law and presidential customs. Today, we are sending a message. No one is above the law.
Senator Brad Hoylman is the sponsor of the bill that would allow Congress to see the president's state tax returns. Trump is a lifelong resident of New York, and many of his businesses are headquartered here. Hoylman says the concept is not new and that New York State already routinely shares people's tax returns with other states and the IRS.
We are simply expanding that authority to allow the state tax department to share that information with one of three congressional committees, the House Ways and Means Committee, the Senate Finance Committee, and the Joint Committee on Taxation.
The president and his aides are currently resisting attempts by Democrats in Congress to see Trump's federal taxes. Supporters of the New York bill hope that the state tax returns will give the congressional investigators clues on what might be contained in the president's federal tax returns. Senator Todd Kominski is sponsoring a second bill. It ensures that state prosecutors can still pursue criminal cases, even if the person is pardoned by Trump. The measure adds an exception to what's known as the double jeopardy protection law.
New York is a sovereign entity, and if a law was broken here, we should not tie the hands of our prosecutors and our citizens to seek redress for that and to bring that before a grand jury.
The president has so far not pardoned any of his associates who face or are serving jail time for crimes, including his former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and his former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. But Trump has pardoned others, including former Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio and conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza. Trump has several times raised the possibility of pardons for his former associates. Republican Senator Andrew Lanza, in debate on the Senate floor, warned Democrats about tampering with what he calls a fundamental tenet of the U.S. Constitution, which prevents governments from trying a person more than once for the same crime. He accused the Democrats of being blinded by political considerations.
We're going to throw freedom into the garbage heap. We're going to allow tyranny to once again get a foothold on these shores. We're going to open the door to the idea that government is in control, that government has the power, that your rights and your freedoms are subservient to the whims of tyranny. Hate who you like. Please don't hate freedom.
Democrats say the measure is limited in scope and only applies to presidential pardons. Senate GOP Minority Leader John Flanagan, speaking earlier in the week, says the bill to make it easier to obtain Trump's taxes is a blatantly political act.
We should be spending our time worrying about what we can do for New Yorkers. When I'm on a street corner, or if I'm in my own home community, or anyone of my colleagues is talking to their constituents, the first thing on their agenda is not talking about the president's tax returns. They want to know about what's happening with flooding in Lake Ontario. What's going on with college affordability?
Senate Leader Stewart-Cousins denies that the measures are politically motivated. She says the Senate is simply acting to fulfill a need.
It's very clear that we, as lawmakers, make laws to fit circumstances of the day. This is a circumstance of the day.
Governor Andrew Cuomo supports the two bills, but the measures have not yet been approved in the Assembly. Speaker Carl Hastie says his Democratic members still need to discuss the bills in their private party conference. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, this week, interesting interview with the youngest ever elected woman in the state Senate. She's a Democrat, a declared Democratic Socialist. It's Senator Julia Salazar. She came in with a wave of folks like AOC and others, and she has quite a few ideas about what she wants to do as a senator.
Well, she certainly is refreshing. Youngest woman, youngest senator comes in and has a different way of looking at politics than the same old people who have been running it for a long time. What's interesting about this, David, is that you have a state senate which has many of these people, but also many people who are in the middle. In other words, more conservative, who are elected in conservative suburban districts. And I asked her about that, and she made it clear that the whole state has to be looked at, because if you push so hard that the left is in the ascendancy, you basically are threatening your own majority, who you have just elected. Those people in the suburbs, Long Island, Westchester, who are Democrats who just got elected, they have to be protected. And what was refreshing about Senator Salazar was that she seemed to understand that.
She also was quite honest about the tiff that erupted between her and some of her fellow senators and the governor over the Amazon failed deal.
Well, look, they messed up. There's no question in my mind about that. They did. Amazon was lost with all of those jobs. And New Yorkers don't like it. We've seen that in the polling. We've seen that across the board. But they're still doing a rear guard fight on that. Look, I'm a huge fan of Mike Gianaris and Senator Salazar and so many other fresh voices. Nevertheless, they messed up there. And instead of fighting this rear guard action, maybe they just ought to admit it.
Rent control, very interesting subject to talk about. Certainly people think New York City, but there's been a coalition that's been developed, and it may be moving upstate.
Well, we all remember at least one candidate who was yelling at the top of his voice, the rent is too damn high. Rent is, of course, a big issue. The New York Times just had a very interesting article which basically said people are thinking now rent rather than buy, and particularly older people are saying rent rather than buy. In fact, it's very tough. In Albany, not so bad. In New York City, impossible. What was once considered a $100 apartment now runs into the thousands. So people are giving up their jobs rather than give up their apartments because the rent issue is first and foremost in their minds, and the rules are so convoluted that people will do almost anything to keep an apartment. So this has got a lot of people saying, okay, let's do something about controlling rents. Well, when you control rents, the landlords say, well, we're not going to put the money in that we need to keep these things up. There's some truth to that, although the greed of some of the landlords is palpable, that's for sure. And whether it happens or not, we'll see. But now you have both houses of the legislature in the hands of the Democrats, and it's more likely than it ever has been when the Republicans were in control.
Senator Salazar, also the chair of the Women's Committee on Health, and a number of issues that affect women, including things like comprehensive contraceptive coverage and sexual harassment issues. And one of the things that struck me was she mentioned the alarming maternal mortality rate.
Well, that's right. And we do know that those people who have the least are more likely to die. It's that simple. We know that people who have more resources are more likely to successfully get through having a baby. And once again, and this is no shock, those people who have the least are in the most danger.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York U.S. Senator Charles Schumer was in Colonie this week to promote a new bill addressing fraudulent robocalls. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King was there.
If you own a phone, odds are you've received a robocall, probably a lot more than one. Speaking at the Colony Senior Services Center, Schumer says New Yorkers received over 290 million robocalls, automated phone calls with pre-recorded messages, just this past month. The Democrat says 42% of those were from scammers. Standing alongside Schumer, Albany resident Mackenzie Pope says she's been the target of a wide range of scams.
A lot of times it's the same thing over and over again. It's a credit card I don't own, or an account from a bank that I have no idea where they're located. Or my favorite is the police are coming for me. I need to buy $1,000 of iTunes gift cards and send it to some random person online.
Or you'll
online.
Get arrested, they tell you.
Yes.
And they scare people, particularly senior citizens.
Schumer says robocalls initially dropped following the installation of the National Do Not Call Registry in 2003, but improvements in technology have since allowed, quote, the bad guys to get ahead of the good guys, end quote.
First, they had a technology where you can be anywhere and push a button and it'll make 1,000 calls. You know, you don't have to dial it anymore. It's like computerized. But second, and worse, they figured out ways to hide their phone numbers so you could never track them.
In a practice called spoofing, robocallers can disguise their numbers with local area codes to seem more legitimate and trick people into picking up. Schumer says residents of Syracuse have been particularly bothered over the past 2 weeks as phones rang late into the night, sometimes as late as 3 a.m.
And some of these calls, many of them, I'll tell you the story, many of them come from overseas. And if you call back, even though you're dialing the 518, or in Syracuse it was 315, you get a charge for an international call late at night.
Schumer's legislation is the Bipartisan TRACED Act, led by Republican John Thune of South Dakota and Democrat Ed Markey of Massachusetts. Schumer says the bill helps coordinate law enforcement agencies to crack down on robocallers by raising fines to $10,000 a call and extending the statute of limitations from 1 year to three. Most importantly, Schumer says it forces carriers to help fight back against spoofing technology.
The carriers, Verizon, AT&T, they can arrange it so the real number comes through. It's an international number. And they catch it and stop it. They don't let them do this. So we would require every single carrier to have this system which will block the robocalls and they never come to you.
Schumer feels confident the bill will pass within the next couple of months.
You know, all the fights, Democrats, Republicans, partisanship, this one will move like a hot knife through butter. Everyone wants to stop these and everyone gets these calls. Maybe even the president, who knows?
Until then, he recommends recipients refrain from answering or returning calls from numbers they don't recognize. But Mackenzie Pope has received 15 robocalls in the past week. And as a young mother, not answering the phone doesn't really feel like an option.
I have two young children, one of which is going to be starting preschool, and his preschool will be starting to call me, possibly to pick him up if he becomes ill. Their doctor's offices call me to let me know if they need to reschedule an appointment, confirm appointments.
According to the Truth in Caller ID Act of 2009, robocalls are illegal if used for the purpose of causing harm or fraud. Reporting from Colony for the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
The Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant in New York is a year away from permanently closing one of its two operating reactors. After the plant shuts down, it will be sold. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has an update.
The sixth meeting of the Indian Point Closure Task Force was held about a week after Indian Point's parent company, Entergy, announced it would sell the plant after shutting down. Entergy agreed to a post-shutdown sale of the Buchanan-based plant to a subsidiary of Holtec International. An April 25th meeting of the task force included information from Entergy officials about the sale. Task Force member Sandy Galef, whose state assembly district includes Indian Point, is eager to learn more from Holtec, but believes the proposed sale makes sense and felt the meeting overall was positive.
Holtec, who will take it over and be the decommissioning company, seems to be committing to getting it done faster, not waiting. Entergy said it could be up to 60 years. That would not be a good plan. And so that they could, get it done quicker, which would mean that they've been able to use the property sooner for other economic opportunities. There are a couple pieces of property there right now that could be used, and whether Holtec will let them, spin those properties off, I don't know, whether they will or they won't.
In a statement announcing the intended sale, Holtec's president said the company would complete decommissioning decades sooner than Entergy, potentially releasing the site considerably earlier for redevelopment, which could benefit the local economy. Democratic State Senator Pete Harcum's 40th district contains Indian Point.
The real questions need to be answered by Holtec, and Entergy said that they thought Holtec would be willing to come to the next meeting to address those questions. You know, I have concerns about the jobs. There are 1,200 jobs there, so I have legislation to protect those jobs, saying that Holtec would need to go to the existing workers first and pay them what they're being paid now once those union contracts expire.
Harcum introduced his bill about a week ago. Holtec's president, also in the statement, says the company will hire Entergy's employees at Indian Point who are employed at the site at the time of the transaction and identified by Entergy as being required for that phase of decommissioning. Assemblywoman Galef also has concerns for Indian Point employees.
There was somebody there from the Labor Department, and they're still working on trying to reformat people's jobs into other solar industry or some other industry, or maybe, you know, working for Con Ed or the New York Power Authority. So there's work going on with that, with training and getting resumes out and so on.
Harcum has additional concerns.
I'm concerned about this being done safely and responsibly, as many of the community members are. And I'm also concerned about the state cessation fund to make these communities whole, as the tax payments from Entergy are gradually reduced. So there are a lot of moving parts. You know, I think everyone is right now is working in good faith. But there are a lot of questions that we need to answer together.
Nuclear Regulatory Commission spokesman Neil Sheehan.
They want to do the prompt decommissioning, which would call for dismantling the structures in the near term, radiologically cleaning up the site, and then they would have to manage the spent fuel for until such point as the federal government is able to take the fuel from the property. And so we have not yet received a license transfer application from Holtec and Entergy, and so we'll wait to see that.
Holtec is interested in purchasing a number of nuclear power plants, including Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Massachusetts and Oyster Creek Nuclear Generating Station in New Jersey. And the NRC has to approve the license transfer application. Sheehan says that opens the opportunity for anybody to request a public hearing.
We tell companies that are interested in these kind of license transfers to expect it to take up to about a year. It really depends on the quality of their submissions, the number of questions we have, and whether or not a hearing is granted.
Indian Point Unit 2 and Unit 3 are scheduled to shut down by April 30th, 2020 and April 30th, 2021, respectively. Indian Point Unit 1 was shut down in 1974.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Governor Andrew Cuomo and public officials around the state continue to blame the International Joint Committee for the high water levels in Lake Ontario. While IJC critics point to Plan 2014 being the root of the problem, other Great Lakes experts say Mother Nature is playing a bigger role. The Innovation Trail's Nick Lippa visited Olcott to speak with residents about the issue.
Memories of violent 2017 waves linger in the minds of property owners along the Lake Ontario shore. Flooding ended up costing New York State $100 million in recovery funding, but Newfane Town Supervisor Timothy Horenberg says they still haven't recovered.
We're still dealing with FEMA on doing some repairs to some walls and stuff along municipal walls that are built along the lake that we can't fix because the water's been too high.
Horenberg says emergency town funds have to be allocated primarily for lake flooding.
We get a certain percentage of reimbursement, but there's certain percentage that has come out of our pockets.
David Headley is one landowner that was hit hard in 2017. He owns a boatyard that was founded by his great-grandfather over 100 years ago.
He built this boatyard and all of these docks to the old plan.
The recent plan implemented in 2014 allows for Lake Ontario to fluctuate between higher and lower water levels. So when landowners like Headley were asked to invest their own money to fix damage done by the lakes in 2017, they became angry.
Why should I take out a loan to repair the damage that was caused by this flood? And this flood is not a natural disaster. It's not caused by Mother Nature. It's man-made. They're holding the water back all winter long. And then when they start letting it out, it's too late. Who is responsible? That's what I'd like to know.
Officials like Governor Cuomo and Congressman Chris Collins point to the IJC in Plan 2014. But UB's Great Lakes Program Associate Director Helen Domsky says it's more complex than that.
The top scientists in the Great Lakes agree that it wasn't the IJC plan that caused the flooding in 2017. It was the fact that we had this unnatural amount of rain on top of a heavy snowpack that melted.
Domsky says climate change is bringing greater storms, which leads to higher lake levels. That's something Governor Cuomo recently acknowledged could be the new norm.
I think we had over 60 inches of snow in January. That's incredible. That's an incredible amount of snow that has to melt and go somewhere.
Demsky says even if the lake goes up by 11 inches in May, it would still be a foot lower than it was in 2017.
I can see why people are concerned, and I was a homeowner. I had a house. I had a cottage for a number of years, and I know what the water levels can do. But we just hope that Mother Nature doesn't put forth a big rainstorm or a big windstorm that will move that water around and cause additional erosion.
More than 800,000 sandbags and hundreds of pumps have been put in place along Lake Ontario. Horenberg says they feel more confident this time around.
We have some things that we did in 2017 that are still there, but we learned from 2017, so I think we'll have a not an easier time, but it won't take us as long as to respond the right way.
Governor Cuomo recently said he'd like to invest money into a waterfront that can sustain higher water levels. But how long would it take and when would it happen? Headley, who can't rent 45 docks in the immediate area of the harbor outside his building currently, is running out of time.
With all those docks unrented, I'm losing $87,000 a year. But when the taxes come, $30,000 a year in property taxes, who's going to pay it? I have no income here.
Over the past 2 years, Headley says not much has gotten done to help smaller communities like Newfane.
This is my family's 100-year-old business I'm trying to save to pass on to my son. And if something isn't done now, not 10 years from now while it goes through the Senate and Congress and all the other bull that they pull, I'm going to lose it.
That's the Innovation Trail's Nick Lippa reporting. The University at Albany celebrated its 175th anniversary this week. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there and filed this report.
UAlbany's Uptown campus opened in 1964 along with new dormitories. Edward Durell Stone's futuristic design inspired urban legends that the campus was originally intended to be built in distant India or Saudi Arabia. A time capsule was placed in a cornerstone of the Dutch Quad dormitory complex. Brian Fessler, past president of the Alumni Association, describes the contents.
The time capsule was created by the first students ever to live on the Uptown campus and sealed in the cornerstone of Dutch Quad, their new home. The items include a custom sweatshirt with a note explaining the unique design, the campus viewpoint booklet, school bulletins, and a note from the Dutch Quad students to future generations of UAlbany students.
More than half a century later, the school is three campuses strong with 180,000 alumni spanning the globe. The 175th anniversary celebration began Tuesday morning at Draper Hall on the original downtown SUNY campus, where Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan proclaimed it University at Albany Day. Later, at the Uptown campus, UAlbany President Javidan Rodriguez joined with senior leadership, faculty, staff, students, alumni, and community members at the official opening of the time capsule.
On May 7th, 1844, the New York State Legislature voted to create the New York State Normal School. And the rest, as they say, it's history. Actually, 175 years worth of it, right? And so, there you go. Come on.
And that was followed by a birthday party.
Happy birthday, dear you, Albany. Happy birthday to us.
Rodriguez helped blow out the candles on the party cake. Rodriguez said he is optimistic about the campus's future.
We remain committed to inspire the aspiring, to create a climate where diverse voices thrive, and to support the great minds to lead the charge, challenge convention, and turn possibilities into promise.
Sophomore Juying Yang from Taiwan is excited to be part of Albany history.
Promotion to, for example, to my family and to friends to sell Albany already 175 years. And it's very proud of to be a part of Albany students.
Graduate student Bradley Hershenson is with the College of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and Emergency Preparedness.
You know, we're proud to be students at an R1 research institution, and it really means a lot to be here.
What do you think of this time capsule?
I think it's really great. You know, this is stuff that's indicative of academic success from a long time ago, and it's really important to look at where we came from and see where we are.
An exhibit honoring UAlbany's impact on the education of New Yorkers is open inside the Legislative Office Building public entrance through May 13th, showcasing images of alumni through the years and current students.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
That about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1919. Or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina.